Blog Talk Radio.
Reason is our weapon of choice. Skeptics know that you do have a voice. Science is not, so we'll be defying it. It's what we know, so it's best to apply it. Be you information, deposits and knowledge, so you know ignorance is not an option. Welcome to the RSS feed with your host, Raina Rose. Skeptical superwoman, but in plain clothes. She ain't no Jane Doe, nor is she a day old. So no cold arguments, weakly molded like Plato. Kicking false info like Kato, but it should be a J-O. To expand your mind like a transit line. Nothing is ever true, cause you think so. It's evident that you never win, cause the evidence you present is irrelevant. In the present tense, it's reckless and negligent. Never ask questions or to think ignorance is good and relishing. So we spark debate, cause you know the truth is hard to take. Especially with so many falsehoods that we are today. Ocean reality, we start to face. Shout out to the skeptics, my freak thinking. Deliver cow, massage, I fire a heat seeking. Aim that you shoot to win the leg. You weak creatures, Christian science institute debate evolution. Elitists in the government that hate the revolution. Armchair activists who overstate their contribution to the movement, cause they say they have solutions. So it's best to listen and understand skepticism is the religion. And so we get a better vision of how the world works in what we call marvelous to make a better future. You know that it starts with us. Progressive thoughts, progressive talks, the sharing of ideas, the medicine we need. Another dose of the RSSD. Say what? Another dose of the RSSD.
Hey everybody, this is Raina. And this is another episode of the RSS feed. Today, I have a special guest, a friend of mine from my undergraduate days when I used to do Nerd Bowl, otherwise known as the Hardy Football Challenge. And you know, Robert and I have kept in touch. He's a really, really intelligent guy. I think you guys will like what he has to say. Be talking a little bit about VAWA. The Violence Against Women Act, women's rights, and we might get into some legal marijuana. That was not intention, you know, the intention of this particular show, but it kind of got put into the title, so I guess we got to talk about it now. But but yeah, so we'll you know, we'll have a lot of different things to talk about today. You guys can call in if you want in a little bit. Hopefully, you know, you guys won't be calling in immediately, since the show just started, but the number to call is 310-982-4273. So, Robert, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, other than that you're a nerd, you know, obviously.
I'm a lifelong nerd, and I'm kind of gotten used to it by now. Well,
yeah.
You know, we've been friends since undergrad when we were in Honda. I graduated from Alcorn. Got my BA in political science. I just finished my master's in political science from Jackson State. I do a lot of writing. I own a small business right now. Yeah, just trying to live the American dream, as they say.
And don't forget about the other thing. One of the reasons why I asked you to come on the show is you're also a Mason.
Well, yeah, I'm a Mason. I'm a member of a three-letter fraternity, so, you know, kind of involved in everything.
Yeah, and right, and a fraternity as well. So, so by definition, that means you're in the Illuminati, right?
No, what is the Illuminati? I've heard, it's funny because I hear that all the time, but I don't even, I mean, I know the historical reference to the group, but I don't understand why it's so, why people are so hung up on it now. I mean, I don't know it to exist or anything like that, but it's just a thing you get a lot of times when you're a Mason or you're, or our friends are Eastern Stars, like, are you a part of the Illuminati? I'm like, what is that, you know?
Right, right. So can you just, I know you can't talk about everything that's involved because, I mean, what's the point of being in one of these groups where you have to be initiated if, like, everything, you know, is just out there for consumption. But, you know, can you talk about a little bit about what drew you into wanting to be a Mason or wanting to be a part of a fraternity and what you, you personally get out of it, you know?
Well, I think everybody wants to belong or wants to belong to a group of people that share similar, you know, similar goals and aspirations and ambitions. A lot of people join fraternities because they want to be around like-minded individuals. I mean, some people join, like I joined my fraternity because some of the members of the organization, you know, Du Bois, you know, Dr. King, they were very inspirational when I was growing up. I read a lot about their achievements and what they did to help their fellow man out, to help their race, to help humanity as a whole. And
right.
that was one of the reasons why I joined my fraternity, to be a part of that, to maybe help, you know, build on that legacy. And I think some people join because of that. I mean, some people join, you know, undergrad just to be a part of the social scene. I mean, it depends on the individual aims in joining the organization, really to see, you know, why would they join the organization. That was why I joined. I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. So
And so confirm for us all that, you know, you guys aren't doing anything over there that's, like, satanic or anything, right? Like, you're not, like, you know.
I wish some of the things people say we did was actually happening. It would be a lot more interesting. But imagine going to a PTA meeting and just sitting there and taking notes and going through, you know, voting, going through different motions, collecting money. That's pretty much all it is. It's like a social club. It's like going to the PTA. It's very, very dull. I don't get all the sensation around it. It really is.
There's no blood sacrifices? That's so boring.
No, I wouldn't be there then. I'm afraid of blood. I hate needles.
So this is so disappointing. You're supposed to get on here and confirm all of our fears. No,
I'm sorry. I wish it was. I mean, it is. It's bland. It's like joining a club, like when you're in school. It's like joining any type of organization, a club. You go there, you know, everyone has, you know, especially if you're in a fraternity or a social group, everyone has their way of coming, you know, coming into the room. You know, everybody has their little signs, you know, things like that. You know, everyone does the vote. But other than that, it's not really anything out the ordinary. It's really not spectacular. It's just blah, mostly.
Okay. Okay, so I guess we can move on from there and maybe get into some of today's topics. So, of course, for those of you that have been hiding under a rock, President Obama signed into law the Violence Against Women Act.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a really good thing because it not only adds protection for LGBT identifying people, but also for Native American women.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm sorry?
No, go right ahead. I was listening to what you were saying.
Yeah. So, you know, not only, you know, without this protection for Native American women, it was basically okay for non-Indians to attack Indian women and not be tried in Indian courts or Native American courts.
I know that they fall under federal. I think if my political science serves me right, they fall under federal jurisdiction. Am I correct? I believe so. Native American women living on those who are at any Native people living in the reservation are under federal jurisdiction. Am I correct? I'm trying to remember correctly.
Yeah, I believe
it's
that.
It's been a while. It's been a while.
Yeah.
I mean, interrupt
you. Oh, no, it's fine. But yeah, so these additions were important. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's so interesting that. It's not interesting. I mean, the Republicans have a very long history when it comes to civil rights and expansion of civil rights to minority groups.
The blocking of civil rights for any minority group.
just about any minority group. It really should come as no surprise that they weren't willing to reinstate the bill and expand it to protect these additional groups. But And it really shouldn't be surprising to us, given their views on rape according, you know what I mean? Some of them have tried actively to change the definition of rape, you know, to discredit non-violent sorts of rape.
Non-violent,
rape by coercion, you know, and date rape and those types of things. You know, what do you think?
I mean, like you said, the Republican Party has a lot of times been on the wrong side of history when it comes to any type of expansion of civil rights concerning any minority group. It's sad that this country has had a terrible history of violence against anybody who's not the status quo. That's African Americans, that's Native Americans, that's women, that's LGBTA. It's funny to me because we talk about how everyone is protected, everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, but our society doesn't practice that same gospel it preaches on a daily basis. The history of the country is full of immigrants. The country was founded by people who came from a different country seeking religious freedom and personal freedom. But that same religious personal freedom is a lot of times denied to many people who aren't the status quo.
Right. And who aren't white Protestant men.
Yeah, who aren't the status quo. And it baffles me because I don't understand how this country seeks to include people when it excludes people every day. Especially women. Women are, all women are the source of society. I mean, women are nurturers. Women are the people who have the kids and everything. And something so fundamental that should be a given has so much of a problem with people trying to, you know, have it being passed. It really baffles me on the direction that a lot of the lawmakers, especially the Republican Party, is headed. You know, I think this is just another example of how they will continue to be on the wrong side of history until they decide to change the image of their party.
But a lot of this, though, you know, and you're talking about religious freedom and what have you. Mm-hmm. A lot of this, though, particularly from the Republican Party, is steeped in religious ideology, or in a particular type of religious ideology.
One of my favorite quotes from philosophy class was by Karl Marx, where he says, "Religion, to whom purpose? It's the opium of the masses. To whom purpose does it serve?" That the origin of religion a lot of times being used as a tool of oppression or a tool of control is all in history. You have the Crusades. Great Inquisition. Even with the KKK when they had Christian principles, but they still used racism to attack and kill black people. I mean.
Right.
Religion is always, when you look at great crimes in history or great crimes against people, I hate to say it, sometimes religion is not too far from being one of the motives behind it for some reason. I never understood that because religion is supposed to be the total opposite. It's supposed to uplift, encourage, and inspire people, not be used as a tool of control, manipulation, and hurt.
Well, I certainly could get with, you know, with people, you know, subscribing to religion a lot more if they were to subscribe to that kind of religious belief, you know, that seeks to uplift people and what have you. But it always seems that most people are, you know, keen on using it to,
as a tool,
you know,
as
to
a
oppress
tool,
other people.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand why. I mean, it's one of those questions that I think I would never understand. Just like we talked about women and the problems women have encountered in all minority groups. Those are one of those questions. I think that's one of the questions, being a political science major as myself and also being someone who reads history, avid, you know, historian, I never understand why this country has that problem. the use of religion. Because if you look at the Constitution, it has a separation. It was to protect the state from the church. Because you notice in Europe back in maybe a few hundred years ago, religion ran state affairs, and that caused a lot of problems.
Right.
You know, so I don't understand. Yeah, I probably never get that one.
That as much as we have that in our Constitution, there's since its inception, we've had issues with it and people trying to enforce it. I mean, even when it's not enforced strictly by our legislators or, you know, our president in the form of, having, you know, these national days of prayer that are supposed to be inclusive but are mostly just, you know, it's mostly just said to be inclusive for political reasons. But it really is about promoting Christian privilege and in this country that's supposed to be a secular country. And the people like myself who are secular, who don't have a particular belief in any organized religion or faith, it's really exclusionary for us. You know what I mean?
It upsets me because I don't consider myself too religious, but I consider myself, I consider myself a Christian, but I don't, the problem I face a lot of times is seeing the exclusion. I don't understand why they're exclusion. I mean, the principles, if you look at every major faith, the principles are do unto others as you have them do unto you, treat your neighbor as you want to be treated, do right, you know, all the good, you know, things that are in our society. But you have, like I said, I think with any group, with any type of fashion, you have a part of that larger group that has different type motives. I mean, with religion, right, with politics, with philosophy, with, you know, funding. You know, I think any major group or any subgroup has small bad apples within that will use that as a tool of oppression, control, or whatever. So it's just trying to make that group smaller should be the goal, I believe.
Yeah. You know, and sorry, we strayed a little bit from the topic of VAWA, but I really want to get back to this thing about the VAWA and some of the vitriol that was kind of spewed from Republicans concerning it, because there seems to be a lot of animosity, particularly to provisions that would protect transgendered people. You know what I mean?
I think of it like this. I mean, politics works kind of interesting and it works kind of differently. The Republicans, I think, well, this is my opinion on the subject. Republicans know most people who are different from them are not going to vote for them. So,
right.
I mean, in politics, they teach you support your base, people who are going
right.
to vote for you, people who are going to support you. So
right.
if you're different, I mean, I'm just going on a basic philosophy. If you're different from me and I believe you're not going to vote for me, why am I going to support things I think are going to help you? I mean, if you look, it's evident. You look at the past Democratic National Convention, the Republican National Convention. Look at the Republican National Convention. What did you see? You saw mostly the same, you know,
right.
mostly older, you know, white gentlemen, you know, Caucasian gentlemen. And then you look at the Democratic National Convention, you saw a mixture of people.
Right.
I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just looking at what I see. I see two different perceptions.
Right.
I'm not saying that the Democrat Party is better than the Republican Party. I try to remain neutral, you know, on subjects of politics a lot of times. But
mm-hmm.
it seems the effort and attempt to include others is more apparent.
Or at least there seems to be more of an effort to at least be tolerant. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
I mean, regardless of whether or not
mm-hmm. I want to say that I approve of the way that you live, or I want to
mm-hmm.
see that, you know, in my daily life, you know,
mm-hmm.
I can tolerate that you live this way or that you want these things. And I can support you on the basis that we should have the same rights. You know what I mean? In general,
that's the first step. I think that's the first step in a lot of things. Tolerance and understanding. Like, I understand this is you know, tolerance, understanding this is who you are. I may not agree with who you are, but I can tolerate and understand you are who you are. And my job as another human being is to respect that, and also protect that right, because I have that same right too.
Right.
So
and my rights are directly connected to yours.
To your right.
And it's something if they can take something away from you, they can take it from me. You know.
Yeah, but that solidarity is not really evident a lot of times in different groups. If you look at it. If you look at more African Americans, I think we have more of a community solidarity type understanding when it comes to an issue like that, like for example, police, you know, brutality or civil rights or, you know, the church. We have more of a community inclusion solidarity type feel on things a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of different groups don't have that same solidarity when it comes to, I think more. They don't have that solidarity, but I think minority groups are better displaying of the solidarity, but other groups don't, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I certainly agree with that. I think, though, what I'm bothered by in terms of, you know, some of the solidarity I've seen in the Black community is solidarity in the way
misdirected.
That some of us... Yeah, it's misdirected, exactly, like... you know, there's, particularly in the Black community, we tend to be very socially conservative in general.
Yeah.
And that has a long historic past. And, you know, you may or may not have read this or heard about this book, Robert, but I recommend it to everybody.
Okay.
It's called Moral Combat by Sikivu Hutchinson. And she talks about, like, you know, how, you know, particular type of religious ideology has been tied to the American identity, and that Black people had to, in many ways, kind of not just adopt that, but kind of like go further. You know what I mean?
I can understand that terminology, because I think if you look at the history of African Americans, especially during slavery time, we used religion as a tool of coping.
Right.
We use it as a tool to make the calm our psyche. And I think we took that a little further and becoming a place of comfort and can become in a place of refuge. And as time went on, we came to use the church as a crutch to kind of in society and culture. Then during the civil rights movement, the church became a meeting place more so. So it became a crutch of social meeting. So I think really that's why I think a lot more of us are socially conservative, because we have such a deep root in religion and in the church.
Well,
so.
Yeah, and not just, but it's not necessarily just the religion that she talks about. It's the wanting to counteract the notion that we were immoral, savages, hypersexual, you know, all of these sorts of things that Blackness was associated with, you know,
those
before
are the stereotypes.
And during slavery, and still even today, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're sort of saddled with, and so we had this desire to kind of counteract that
stereotypes. Yeah, we were,
right.
I think a lot of times, like I say, talk more about the slavery period, those stereotypes were used as a means of control. Soon, you know, with the black codes or whatnot, the laws were after Reconstruction, Voidaire, you know, the abolishing of all the different rights that we have received after the Civil War, even up to current day. I think, yeah, like, I agree with that. The hyper-conservative is just to combat those stereotypes that have been out for so long.
Right.
But it's unfortunate when I see it, because
what I see is a group that has been oppressed, that is still, you know, systematically oppressed in many ways, then turning and helping to oppress another group, a group that actually overlaps with its own, because we have members of our community who are Black
I've had this
and trans, transgendered, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, you know what I mean, and all of it.
It's funny. It's so funny. I had this discussion with a group of my friends a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We talk about this. It's kind of like it was this theory I studied in, I'm trying to think of the name of the theory. It's called system justification, if I can remember it correctly. People within a system would justify the same system. So if you've been in a system of discrimination and anything that's and been taught anything different from the status quo is wrong, then that the people that have been discriminated against would take that system and can either afflict it against another group or afflict it against itself, if I remember the theory correctly. So I see that a lot. I think that's really I never really understood that thinking of why where African Americans being so socially conservative in that thinking would lash out against other minority groups who are suffering some of the same issues that they've been having in society, like, you know, discrimination and regression of their rights. I mean, I never understood. I mean, I think of it like this. Those members of our whole society, our group, you know, the different sects within the African American community suffer the same fate as a lot of us, you know, a lot of other people who are straight, you know, whatever, who are the status quo. So, like I said, back to what I talked about the solidarity angle, what I was talking about earlier, if their needs are not being met, then the whole entire community is suffering, you know, and that's something I never understood. Why you cut your hand off despite your fingers, but you cut your nose off despite your face. We're all in this together as different minority groups. We have to work together to be able to make some necessary changes. And I don't understand why a lot of times African Americans or people who are socially conservative tend to use people's status against them. When that was used against you for 100, 200, 300 years. That's something that, like I said, those questions that I probably would never get the answer to, that's one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like there's just this reluctance to recognize the humanity of, the shared humanity of everybody and to respect, you know, things like body integrity of other people, caring about protecting other people from, you know, violence that is inflicted upon them just because of who they are, you know, or what they do. You know what I mean? And on the part of the Republican Party, they want and other conservatives, they want the right in some sense to discriminate and do harm to these other people, it seems like, to me, you know? Because why then... You know, would you not want to? I mean, there's obviously been, you know, if you look at the statistics, particularly when it comes to like women and domestic violence, like if these statistics were true of men, there'd be a whole initiative.
There probably
tomorrow.
Be like 15 different pages of legislation.
Right.
I agree.
It'd be a whole thing, but because it's women. And it's about domestic violence. The questions become, you know, what did she do? You know what I mean? You know, what was she wearing? You know, was she fulfilling her wifely duties? You know what I mean?
Or,
and it's really sad because we have, you know, we look at Steubenville, and you know, while it seems that there's an actual problem with Steubenville itself because of the number of reports of, you know, sexual violence that have come out of that particular town, there, you know, we have to look at our culture as a whole.
The culture.
And recognize that our culture is sick, you know?
Our culture is in trouble. It's been in trouble for a long time. When you rarely promote violence of any kind over positivity and creativity and educational things, I mean, look what's on TV nowadays. You have an increase of fear. You have a lot of crime shows they're on. You have a lot of action movies on no violence. But you have a decrease in shows that reward people for doing normal stuff. I mean, getting a job, taking care of their family, being part of a social network, to working with other families. You don't see the Cosby Show on TV anymore, except in reruns. You don't see Family Matters on TV anymore, except for reruns. But you see the latest new crime film on that explains how someone just got shot and violence. I mean, I go with some philosophy. I think I forget the name of the philosopher that says, "You think, therefore I think, therefore I am." I think I can't think of the philosopher, French philosopher right now. But you think that I think.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I can't think of his name.
Yeah, I think therefore I am. So if I'm seeing violence, I'm seeing violence all the time. I'm seeing it at home. I'm seeing it on TV. I'm seeing it at school. I'm seeing it everywhere. Then I'm gonna be more prone to be a violent individual. But if you promote positivity, educational stuff, I'm watching TV that has some some educational things, I'm going to probably be okay. It's about
I don't just blame the media though. I mean, although the media is
I don't blame the media.
That's
why I say at home. I said at school. I said I implicated parents. I implicated being at home, the community. I implicated everybody. Everybody plays a part in it. It's not just one.
But I think that we also need to take a look at, because I mean, the way that we legislate and the way that our legislators talk about these matters also has a major effect. So the things that are prioritized up there have an effect on the ground too. You know, so when we see somebody questioning whether or not, a rape where a victim wasn't beaten into submission is actually rape. You know what I mean? Is counterproductive.
I'm trying to put together the laissez-fairness of it all. That's what I'm trying to attack. Violence happened. Okay, that's what I'm trying to attack, the laissez-fair of it. It goes on, but that's what I was trying to attack. The everything happens every day. We need to change that perceptive. Any type of violence against anybody.
I think we also need to name the problem. So, like, just how we know that the problem in this country when it comes to Black people is institutionalized racism, we have to get to a point in our society where people are comfortable naming the problem that is with women, with gays, with, bisexuals, with transgender people is patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And this notion that women are not as much as of people as men, you know what I mean? And we need to stop, we need to change our language and the way that we use language because, we don't just use misogyny against those groups. We also use misogyny against men because men have this idea that they have to be a particular kind of man in order to be a man. And that's the kind of man that does
what happened
in Stephenville.
You have to change the way of thinking. And also you have to put people who are different in positions of power. Put people in position of power so people can see that the stereotypes that they have portrayed against different people are incorrect. You have to find the different, for example, put more women as heads of companies and more women in administrative positions, more minorities in different groups in positions of power. That will help expedite the situation as well and change the perceptions a lot of times. I think I agree with what you're saying, but I think we need to take a more proactive route with the implication of putting more people in those positions of power and being able to
and
change policy.
That, I think we also have to talk about rape. You know what I mean? Like when we talk about.
Yeah, I believe.
Like we talk about sexual education, but we don't talk about rape and sexual education. We don't really talk about what talking to kids and saying yes means yes. You know what I mean?
That's the problem, I think, with any crime. I think the problem with a lot of our problems in this country is we are afraid to talk about it. If you're able to, I agree, if you're able to sit there and talk about it, put it on the table, open up the discussion, I think you're more likely to find a problem or a solution or begin the process of working on that problem.
Right.
And I think we're, as a nation, there's so many things that we're afraid to talk about that we hide behind. We give the PC, the political correct answer. We don't talk about it because we're of fear of retribution. We don't talk about it because we're ashamed of it. We have to take those negative feelings and take those feelings from off the table to better be able to discuss and probably possibly solve the problem.
Right. But yeah, I think you're right though. I think we need to, you know, really have real discussions about that, and we have to have them in public, and we need to have legislators who are educated about these things. Like America, I mean, we're really
America needs to grow up.
Around, and I wonder what century I live in sometimes. You know what
America,
I mean?
I agree. America,
I have an iPad, and I have a cell phone that, like, you know, I have a cell phone that I can use to call anywhere. It fits in my pocket. You know what I mean? I can get information on anything at any time. And yet I live in a country where people are, you know, spending time on, you know, things like, should women be paid the same amount? You know, should they have the same rights? Of course they should. You know,
I said earlier, America needs to grow up. It's time for America to grow up and have adult conversations.
Yeah,
you know, sexism, racism, rape, women's rights, African American rights, Native American rights. It's time for America to stop having behind all these different facades, and it's time for America to start growing up and start dealing with these different situations in order that it may mature. Because you look at any of the great other civilizations, the Roman civilization, the Egyptian, they all fail. Why? From within. Because the people got tired of the government ignoring them, and they stopped listening to the people who they were governing, who they were ruling. America's getting to that point where it's not listening to the people who make the country what it is, and it's really a lot of times following their own, you know, agenda. And that's always the blueprint for a fall of the society.
Right.
So the order of America to get over this hump that a lot of other great civilizations never got over. He has to grow up and be able to have these conversations. To talk about racism, talk about classism, talk about sexism, talk about discrimination, violence, a lot of whatever isms they're left to talk about. America has to be able to have these conversations.
Right.
And we have to find the right medium to get America to discuss these issues, because track record is it's going to continue to duck and dodge these issues. It's done it for almost 240 years. It's ducked issues. It started with, you know, African Americans and women's rights, and then you had Native American rights, and then you had LGBT rights, then you had children's rights. It's America has always been in a position to give an ambiguous answer and move on to the next thing. We need America to sit down and start the process of really dealing with these issues and situations.
Right. Is Kim, are you still there?
Yes, I am still here.
Okay. Are you just enjoying the conversation? Or you can jump in anytime you want.
Hey, no, he is definitely on point. He's correct. You know, we need to grow up in this country and start dealing with these issues. We have to stop playing ostrich, you know, burying our head in the sand and hoping that the situation or the issues will go away is not going to bring about any type of effective change, you know, as demonstrated, it has gotten, subsequently worse. So, you know, we have to deal with the issues. We need to grow up, confront them. No, it's not comfortable. No, it's not easy. There are going to be people with hurt feelings, people offended. You know, we got to find some kind of way to find some type of compromise, some type of, compromise in which, you know, not everybody is going to be 100% happy, but if it's going to help us progress and grow as a nation, that's what's important.
And, you know, another problem that I see America does, they throw money at a situation. They don't effectively look at a policy and go through and put an outline for something that's effective. They either throw money at the situation or they, like I said, they duck and they dive it. That's something that really needs to be looked at. Like, for example, education. You have so many public schools that are failing, and you have kids who are not passing third, sixth, ninth grade tests. I mean,
Right.
You have the facilities, you have the teachers there, you have the resources, but your kids are not passing the state test. I mean, that's the outline for a lot of our problems. We don't discuss it, we throw money at the situation, and we ignore it. I mean,
right.
When you say we're
throwing money at the situation, you also have to take into account that not all that money that we're throwing at the situation actually reaches, you know, the people that it's supposed to.
That's another problem we have to discuss at another time, but it's not being effectively where it needs to go. It's just being, okay, here's $1 million, do this. And then people are not going by. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Like, just like the state lottery systems that are supposed to help, like, you know, the education system. Where does all that money go? It goes to the schools that are already doing okay. You know what I mean? Meanwhile, right down the road, you know what I mean? That school doesn't have books. They don't have working computers. You know?
I come in disrepair. I can even tell you that from my experiences. I went to a public school, and up to my ninth grade year, and I went to private school. And I see the complete difference. When I went to all kinds of state school. I went to state school. I have friends that go to other universities, and I see the difference in their state schools. I go to a state school, but their facilities are much better than my facilities.
Yeah.
What's the I understand that's the same thing you just said. Money's not going where it's supposed to. We both are state schools, both city schools, but why are my facilities not as good as yours, and why am I struggling with old books and you have new books?
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with exactly what you're saying.
But you also had the same problems that I had going to an HBCU, we get on HBCUs all day.
We talk all day about that's another discussion. Right.
All day long. But
you make do.
You make do
what you have.
You do. Boy, that is a whole nother story. getting back to the topic. Going back to the whole you know, Stephenville and, like, sexism and the way that we privilege, like, men in our society or whatever, it brought to mind when I was looking at Stephenville, because, you know, football is major there, you know, just how willing people are to look, you know, the other way when the person is, when the man who's committed, you know, a heinous act or is accused of committing a heinous act, in this case we had plenty of evidence. You know what I mean? That, you know, when they're in power or when they're, you know, they're a professional athlete or even a student athlete or whatever, that they're somehow, that we need to protect them. You know what I mean? The futures that we need to worry about in this case are the futures of the boys that raise
you know, you know, one of my, you know, one of my favorite quotes, one of my favorite quotes is absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
That's the situation a lot of times. People in power protect power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times, I mean, it's unfortunately, most of the times, it's men. Men are, a lot of times, in a position of power. When it comes to position, titles, and you know, that's unfortunate. And we have to, like I said, we have to correct the behavior. We have to correct the thinking, change the perception.
I suspect that you do. But do you identify yourself as a feminist or a humanist or,
I don't really consider myself either. I just consider myself. I try to find out what's right. I try to do what I think is right. I might be a humanist, but I believe in fair treatment of everybody. I believe everyone has the right to be, you know, respected. Everybody should be tolerable or at least respectable to everybody, you know, despite their differences. I believe everyone has a place in the society. Everyone has the right, you know, to pursue, you know, endeavors, you know. I believe,
well,
you know,
how
everyone
do you
should have
cultivate that in other men, because I think that, you know, as much as we, you know, we want to fight, you know, at the legal aspect, that really it's a cultural problem that we have. So how do we, you know, how do we spread that message of, you know, women are people too, and, you know, we're in it together, and, you know, this person, you know, you can't be, we can't all be free until we're all free. You know what I mean? And we can't all be equal until we're all equal.
The problem with spreading that message is since the beginning, this country has been going down that the wrong path since the beginning, and it's going to take a long time to really to bring that message home that all people, women, everyone should be treated fair, equal. That's something that it should be a hallmark of our country, especially on our humble beginnings. But I don't know if that is ever going to happen in this country. It should happen, and we should push for it, and we should fight for it. But like I said, our country's been down that path since the beginning. It's going
to
take a lot of work.
We need to give up or anything. So I'm still.
I don't. No, I don't believe
like
we should give up.
How we can cultivate that, you know,
but
that
I'm talking about
cultural,
the
you know, value.
The complexity. What I'm talking about is the complexity of where to start. It's been so ingrained in society. How do you go about starting the process of redrawing of how society has been going on for almost, you know, 240 years? How do you go about? Where do you start? That's more my question. Where do you start at? Do you, you know, sit people down and talk? That may take years to be able to reach everybody. Do you go about putting a plan of action in that would have like public service announcements weekly? That's what I'm looking at. How would you go about doing the message? I agree that we should move forward in pushing the agenda. But how do you go about doing it is where I'm stuck at. Because
well, I don't know. I think everything you just said is a good place to start.
Oh.
I think we need public service announcements. I mean, I remember when we were kids growing up, right? Like if you couldn't watch anything after school. You can watch anything after school. You can watch anything on a Saturday that didn't have some kind of moral message, you know, attached of tolerance, of, you know, anti-bullying or something along those lines. Like, it was always something. It was always the more you know. You know
what
I mean? Right. Always.
I mean, it's different because it seems that it seems now that that message isn't fun. Like what someone said earlier, we have to sit our kids down at an earlier age and teach them these things, and people in general. It's just I think that message gets lost a lot of times in the flow of everything. You know, we tell everybody that, you know, you should treat everybody correctly. Everyone should be treated equally, but like I said, our society is so slanted. You're told things operate one way, and they operate a totally entire different way. You know, that's for anything. I mean, you're told if you go to college, you get grades, you should be able to find a job. You know, the economy is so slim that people are having problems. You see what I'm saying? It's hard to put that message in more of a form that people can understand and they believe it when you see the opposite a lot of times. How you go about changing that slant? That's what I'm getting. It's hard to change that slant. You know,
I was going to say I'm right there with you, because one of the issues that I had when, you know, I've been through two cycles in which the economy has tanked on me, and this last one really kind of got to me, because it was like I didn't have children that I couldn't afford. I went, got my education, established a career, worked diligently at that career, moved up, and then, you know, invested money in my future, if you will, and then had the rug pulled from under me and had to start over. And so it was like that quote-unquote American dream turned into an American nightmare, because then this is when I got a greater appreciation of what was happening. When you are single with no children, to a certain degree, you're screwed. You know, if you don't have any health care, you have to go through a bunch of red tape and jump through hoops to get help. You know, let's just say, you know, during that time, it was a real education. That's when a lot of my ideologies changed as far as like some of my political ideology, and that's when I became more vocal about other things in my life. But, you know, it makes you wonder. Yeah, exactly. It makes you wonder if this is what we're being told is the ideal situation and the ideal life, and you try to live up to it and you find out that it's not quite so ideal, and they wonder why people are so, you know, disillusioned.
Empty. And another thing, and what we were talking about, the whole everything, you can't change one particular factor without changing all of them. If you can't change sexism, you don't change racism. If you can't change racism, you can't change classism. They all have to be done at the same time in order to change the whole perspective. And that's why I'm so, you know, perplexed at what to do. You have to attack all these different issues at the same time because they all correlate with each other. They all do in one way or another. And
well,
I think,
you know, sometimes I get a little glimmer of hope, and I'll tell you why. Because I feel like the excessive pushback that we see from a lot of the people on the far right is just because of the fear that they have that things are changing too fast. Now they're not changing fast enough for us who, you know, think that they should be changing faster. You know what I mean? We should just be living in this world where people, you know, are at least start off on an equal playing field. You know what I mean?
But sometimes when I
see the activities on the right and just how extreme and vitriolic they are, it almost makes me feel like we're kind of in this, like, last gasp, you know what I mean, of, like,
with the last big battle.
Yeah, like they're desperate to push back, and a lot of them are getting older, and even the people who are coming up, you know, as young people in the Republican Party, you know, are a little more liberal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're not stuck in the old way. They're more open. I'm gonna say they're more open to discussion on things. Instead of just being so deadlocked on no, I mean, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, so, like, sometimes I think, like, maybe there's a little hope, you know?
A little glimmer.
It's almost,
hold on a little longer.
It's a little bit, we could just hold on just a little longer, you know, maybe, you know?
What you said to me is kind of like what I think Dr. King said a long time ago. I hope I'm paraphrasing him correctly. Either you can watch the house burn or you can put the fire out. I think that's what you're talking about right now. Do we sit and let the house burn, or do we try to put the fire out? And it's really, you know, I think it's so hard for a lot of times for a lot of people, especially people on the outside, to want to save the house. That's America. And we're watching it burn, but we're not even being, you know, we had to force our way into the house anyway. I mean, it's really hard. You're stuck. You don't know what to do. You know, if it burns, then, you know, trying to build something new is going to be very hard to do. But what do you sacrifice? Do you sacrifice the building, or you sacrifice yourself? I mean, I think a lot of people caught in that situation, you know. So one of those things that, well, I think we may never figure out, but hopefully it worked itself out. You know, we always think that way. Be hopeful that it will work itself out.
Yeah, we like to be ever optimistic.
That way you get in trouble a lot.
Yeah.
God, my optimism comes utopian.
I try to be realistic. I'm not that kind of an optimist. My optimism is tempered, but
I'm a realist,
mind shift from
time to time. It goes from, you know, being very, you know, bleak and, you know, to be optimistic, being a realist, to balancing out, and then going back one extreme to another. So
I know, and it's so hard, right? Especially right now in the period that we're in with women's rights, right? Because on the one hand, we have a lot of these major battles that we've won at the federal level. You know what I mean? Not always the biggest ones. Like, I think,
but, I mean,
like,
the federal,
ERA should have passed. I should be in an age where there's ERA, but we don't have mm-hmm. that. But, you know, we've been able mm-hmm. to pass, you know, Lilly Ledbetter. We've been able mm-hmm. to, you know, get the Violence Against Women Act, you know, reauthorized and expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the state level, in various states, you know, they're trying to get rid of
all day.
They're trying to get rid of essentially the right for women to have access to safe abortions. You know?
The federal court has always been where civil rights and human rights has always been decided, because the states don't have a great record on individual rights. The states have never had a great record on individual rights. You look at all the different, you know, cases or whatever. You know, like I said, you look at the South after the Civil War. You look at, you know, different states had different problems with, you know, when you had Mexican-Americans coming into the country, when you had Asian-Americans coming in, you had the internment camps, World War II. So states have never really had a great record on human or civil rights. The federal court has always been supposed to have been the safety net. That's why, I mean, it says in the Constitution, when, you know, in the articles, when the Supreme Court supposed to have been the safety net for the country. So they're supposed to be the final say-so on what's right and what's not right, quote-unquote, legally. So the federal court has always been the remedy for minorities groups in their fight to leap to
well,
the level
don't
playing
say
field.
Always with the remedy, because we have
well, most,
really
well,
big
most of the, excuse me,
up.
Most of the time,
yeah.
most of the time, most of
yeah.
the time. I know
some
cases that kind of...
And there are some cases I'm going to
use a term. Look at the reflection of the court now, but that's another discussion too. I mean, between a certain period of time, you know, between about 20, 30 years, the Supreme Court was the last, you know, we get into that discussion another time. But like I said, usually is the remedy and the safety net for the country when it comes to laws. You know, violations of minority rights and whatnot. Usually.
Yeah.
And then
usually within a very confined period of time that benefited us.
Yeah. About 30 years.
Yeah,
I mean, we had a window.
Yeah. It was a very brief window, and
the window kind of closed,
but it wasn't as open.
It's not completely closed. It's just cracked a little right now.
Yeah, it's just cracked a little bit, and we're going to hope a couple of things eke through, you know, when they're ready to hand down the
time.
Yeah.
A little breeze. A little breeze of freedom.
One of the things I'm looking at is what they're going to do about the Voting Rights Act.
The other thing that's going to be
interesting is their decision on DOMA. But what's so interesting is, like, you know, what's so scary, what's really scary about the Voting Rights Act is, you know, all of the justices, you know, with the exception of, you know, Sotomayor and, you know, and maybe Kennedy, you know what I
Kennedy?
Mean?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They look like they might be leaning towards Shelby, Alabama. They might be leaning towards Shelby, Alabama, which is really ironic. Because Shelby, Alabama, you know, because according to, was it Title IV, you know, you have to, you know, certain states under Title IV, they have to report to the Department of Justice.
My home state is one of those states, Mississippi, so I know they have to report any change, any type of change in their voting laws, any type of adjustments or additions that they want to add to their voting law that has to be approved by the Department of Justice first. Because
right.
I know Mississippi just passed.
And some of those districts and some of those states have actually, you know, done a sufficient amount of work that they no longer have to report. But the particular jurisdiction in question has had, like, nearly every one of their laws that they've tried to implement over time, you know, thrown
mm-hmm.
out, you know what I mean? They and tossed back. So they've had every single one rejected, and yet they're at the Supreme Court asking, you know, Title IV, you know, at least Title IV to be overturned, if not the entire thing. But they certainly want the restriction that they have to report
to be,
you know,
yeah, they
any,
to be
any changes
cool. they wanted,
to the DOJ.
Yeah, to be, It's
and that's super scary to me. I mean, I'm like,
it's scary.
I don't live in one of those states. So
you're lucky.
Yeah, I know. Thankfully for me, I don't live in one of those states. But it's still scary
to
me. I mean, it's still very scary.
And you know, like me who grew up. I grew up, and you know, I'm a Mississippi boy. I'm from the South, so it's the look. You want to believe that we'll come to a point in our society that you don't need stuff. You don't need that law. You don't need Section 4 of the Civil Rights Act. But something inside you that says that if as soon as you take that away, things will change. I mean,
there were still states that were still trying to do it.
You still have problems even with the law.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't understand. I mean, I've always been taught if it's not broke, don't try to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has been going, you know, mostly decent, you know, with the law in place. So I see no reason why you're trying to change it
exactly.
Or get rid of it. But
exactly.
You know,
especially when you who are trying to get it overturned are the one that it's meant to protect against.
Yes,
you know?
it's like if you take that out, it's like taking the 19th Amendment away. I mean, yeah, we know women can vote, but they should be able to vote now. As soon as you take that, I bet it's gonna be problems. I know the states. The states have never. I've never seen any case law. The states have been on the side of history. That's just my opinion on the situation. I'm not really for them repealing or messing with any parts of Section 4.
I wish they would have just chosen not to hear the case.
I really think the Supreme Court scares me a lot of times nowadays because they hear a lot of things. And I'm like, we could be working on other issues, but you want to hear this case?
And it makes you nervous as hell because you know who's on the court. You know what I mean?
Don't bring that up. Please don't. Please.
Because you know who's on the court.
I'm trying to be optimistic.
And it makes you nervous. It's all get out. But,
I'm trying to be optimistic. Like you said earlier, I have a glimmer of hope.
I have a glimmer of hope.
I don't want that to fall on me, but
my glimmer vision is really limited. So.
Like a teaspoon right
to,
now.
It's real, like, you know, I guess maybe I'm farsighted. You know what I mean? My glimmer is off in the distance somewhere.
I'm a historian, so, you know, I have to look at history. You know, I'm a political scientist, so I look at numbers, I look at politics, I look at history. So I look at both of those factors a lot of times when I make my stand on a certain ideology or a certain idea on something. I look at it, and if both of those are kind of against you, I kind of, you know, I'm like, well, throw my hands up. Like I said, historically, it's not right, and politically, you know, just trying to hope. That's all I'm trying to do.
It's pretty scary though. It is.
It really is.
But
we laugh a lot of times just to relieve our tension about it, but it really is scary.
It makes you really sad because. You know, in an era where you and I have, and everyone, you know, at this day and age has, you know, probably more rights, you know what I mean, than a lot of us have had at, you know, at any particular time in, you know, history, you know, before.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? We have, you know, we have more access to things. You know, it's scary to think that all of that or a lot of that progress, you know, can be hinged on one item, you know what I mean? One item, which is Title IV, because that would pretty much, I mean, not that it would, Title IV pretty much would render most of the, you know, the Voting Rights Act, you know, useless.
It would take the venom out of the cobra. I mean, when you take the venom out of cobra, what do you have? You have a useless cobra that can't defend itself. And I mean, if you take any part of that act from within an act, you're gonna weaken it. You're gonna greatly weaken it.
Yeah, it's not just the venom; it's the fangs.
Well, you know, you need to faith. Well, you could fight with faith. Your greater venom is not going to die, but you're taking the fangs
out.
You know
what I mean? Like, it's not just the venom; it's the fangs. Too.
Yeah, the fangs and venom. I mean, but I wanted to be more with your back than I said the venom. But
yeah,
you take the fangs and venom out of that. I mean, it's weak. I mean, it's like the Civil Rights Act of '54 and all the acts they tried to pass in the '50s. It's gonna be watered down. It's gonna be weak, and the states are gonna find a way to get over it, like they've done in previous tense. I mean, and then you back to similar situations that you faced in between the '50s and '60s, and. I'm sorry, I can't go through that. My ancestors went through enough. I can't go through that era again.
I know.
I'm going to get my passport. I'm leaving. I'm
sorry. Jim Crow 2.0.
Jim Crow 2K13 2.0.
Right, 2K13 2.0.
Yeah, but.
It's really scary.
Oh, man.
It's really scary.
I mean,
so let's try to get off of that and try to find a happier subject. Let's find a happy place. What are some? Who are some women in history, or even you know, contemporary women that you are that you look up to?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I have a great deal of women I really looked up to. Historically, one of my favorite women, Elizabeth I. Really, Elizabeth I. Indira Gandhi. Mother Teresa.
Okay.
Contemporaries now would be Dr. Merkel, no, the Chancellor of Germany, Margaret Thatcher. The First Lady, she's really, you know, I really like her agenda she's really putting out now, you know, fighting obesity and working with children. I really like that. You know, she found her niche, so per se. I was raised by, you know, my mother and my grandmother, so my first images of women, you know, was good. So I've had a lot of women that I respect and I admire, but, you know, I kind of model myself after, you know, their different political methods, you know, with being Indira Gandhi and Thatcher, Mark Thatcher, you know, or whatnot. So it's a lot of them. Probably a few more than men, and that'd be kind of funny, huh?
So, what I like Shirley Chisholm. I think I liked her fearlessness.
See, Robert Jordan. See, this is plenty. It's so many.
Yeah.
It's so many to choose from. I mean, it's so many women that I admire and I respect and that I respected and respect even now. They probably all day if I start just naming people, you know. So.
Yeah, and if I started quizzing you on them, I bet you'd fire off.
Oh, no. I've actually got real rusty. I can't really do that.
Oh, you got
I'm
rusty?
Not really good. I just now started getting rusty last year.
Oh,
I was playing with a friend of mine, and we're just quizzing each other, and I start forgetting things. I'm like, wow, it's been about 4 years. Okay. Yeah, officially, I fell off. I can't remember anything.
I still remember a lot of that stuff, though.
You know, I can remember, you know, we were talking, but, like, I'll just, you know, drop of a dime, it's kind of hard for me to remember it now. So,
yeah.
It's just, you have to kind of get, you know, get talking. And
no,
then
I remember,
kind of remember.
You were pretty good. You were pretty good back then. So.
Whatever.
I was
decent.
Good.
I was
you were pretty
decent.
Good. I mean, you weren't decent. As good. You weren't as good as Morgan State. But,
whatever. Hey, sound like you're hating now. See?
I'm not hating. I'm just stating
facts. I know. All I have to say, my last year, I was in the championship game. I was 5 points being national champion. That's all I have to say about
that. Well, I wasn't playing that year, so that's probably why that happened.
I mean, that sounds like a problem. I mean, hey, you witness greatness. Go get the tape. Go get the tape. That was a great year.
Whatever.
Yeah, it was a great year.
All I know is not as good as my team. But
I think the following year y'all beat us in the Sweet 16. The following year, like in 2009, I believe so. Yeah, my friends were still on the team. Yeah, they told me about that. But you didn't play me, so okay, did not really count.
Well, I did play you, but I think we won.
I never played you guys.
We never played in the tournament.
We never did.
I think we played in the tournament. I'm sorry.
I don't believe so.
Oh, you know what? That's because you guys didn't make it to. Yeah.
Oh no, no, don't go there now. We had a 71 year, 62 year. Don't go there. Get 262 year. No, you went in the room. I remember.
I was 16 the first year and top 8 the second year.
I mean, hey, it's not our fault. You know, we were very bad rooms. I mean, 7-1, we didn't make it out 1 year. 6-2, we lost on the tiebreaker. 6-2,
well,
we lost
on the tiebreaker. Bad room. We were in a bad room our first and our second year.
Man, all 4 of my years, I was in a bad room. Then the fourth year, I had to go 8-0 to get the room. We had to play Tuskegee Morehouse and Howard just to get to the championship game. So, yeah, I know. Yeah, we made the championship game that year. Talking the third game by 5 points.
He still would have beat us, but it's okay, whatever. Anywho, so, Kimmy, are you there?
I'm too nervous, having flashbacks. Old war stories, huh?
I'd have to check my brackets. I don't remember which teams we had to play that year, but we had some tough teams to get out.
Y'all had to walk in the park.
What'd you say?
Okay. No, back to topic. Let's go back to topic. You walk in the park.
Okay, you know what? You want to try to talk slick on my show? Anyway. I'll take you on now. Kim can pull up the HV, you know, the Honda Camel All-Star Challenge, and we can go right now.
You don't want those problems, okay? Let me let you know.
You don't want them problems. Anyway. Anyway, Kim, do we have any callers?
No, at the moment, no callers. But, you know, this has been great. You know, these are issues that definitely, you know, need to be discussed. And I'm just glad that, you know, we're getting it from, you know, two different perspectives and seeing where the common ground lies. Because, again, you know, for those that have questions or want to dial in, the number is 310-982-4273. Again, 310-982-4273. And they're just hitting on a bunch of different topics. You know, they've been talking about women's issues, women's rights, HBCUs as of late.
You know, okay, and just for y'all listening, it's not that we went to HBCUs and we're not putting HBCUs down. I had a good experience. I can't really speak for Robert, but I think you had a good experience here.
What'd you say?
Mm-hmm. You had a good experience, generally speaking.
I had a great experience. I enjoyed it. I mean, those are some of the best years of my life. I have friends for the rest of my life. I have friends that I'm still really, really close with. HBCU is different. You learn about yourself when you go to HBCU. You really do. Tough as you are for the real world. I always say you tough as you are for the real world. But I wouldn't change any moment, any you know, failure, any achievement. I wouldn't change because it made me who I am now. So that's why I love it.
The only issue that I think that, you know, Robert and I could say that we both had. Is not necessarily with the education or the, you know, mm-hmm. the people at the institution itself, but administration is a main headache that one faces going through at HBCU.
We can talk about that all day.
Yeah, the disorganization and that kind of stuff. But you do learn a lot, and you learn, I can't speak from it, you know, on going to a majority school from the perspective of a undergrad, but I think that there is an experience that one gets going to an HBCU that one cannot necessarily get going to a majority school, and I'll just leave it there.
I agree. I mean, I can only speak because I've been to historically black schools my whole life. It's something about the atmosphere when you get there. You feel different. You develop a pride about yourself. You develop a pride about the school.
Right.
Because every HBCU has its own story.
Right.
And it has its own struggle to survive and exist in. And as you matriculate, you know, your years at school there, you learn that story. So by the time you're ready to graduate, you become part of that story.
Right.
You become part of that history. And I think...
Become
part of that legacy. And it's something that... It's just the stories, you know, between classes and between, you know, going home and school. It's the things you pick up in between that makes HBCU life so much different and more special, in my opinion. You know, like I said, we made a Honda. That was something that, you know, I tell my friends, probably tell my kids down the line that, you know, I had some really wonderful and great moments getting, you know, Alcorn, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. It's an experience that you can't necessarily get if you go to another type of school. But it was an awesome experience. And I'm glad I met Robert, because Robert's cool people, as you guys can all
know. I met a lot of cool people in there. That's why I love it now, you know.
Yeah,
the issue with Tupper earlier, that's the only thing I have against his will, you know, but...
Yeah, that administration stuff is ridiculous.
It can't be all positive.
You have to have a headache somewhere along the line. It's always got to be something with class schedules or money not coming
about
in.
It's so funny. Each year has to be a different headache. It can't be the same headache as the year before.
Yeah.
Each year was something different. Like, first year for me, it was money not coming in. Second year, it was money not. First year was my class schedule. Third year was activities and everything. Fourth year, it was something new every year. Man, so many different situations. And I think you learn a lot of things on the fly, too, going to HBCU. Like, you know, as being a member of a couple of club organizations, we didn't have a treasurer or a secretary. So I had to learn how to, you know, keep the books, and learn how to take notes in the meetings. And I'm the president. I'm not supposed to do all this stuff, but I learned how to do everything. Right. Multitasking, you know. So
yeah,
it's easy
for sure.
Yeah.
Oh man, sorry, Kim. I know you can't really relate. So
Yes. I think everyone has that undergrad experience is special by this thing HBCU. It's something
different. Yeah, you can't even put it all into words.
You can't. You know? It's stories I can tell you, like, you know, off. I can tell. But, you know, it's something. It's a feeling. You can't really describe it. Like you said, a lot of times it's a feeling you get.
Yeah, like,
you
know, I still have relationships with a lot of my old professors. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, same thing with me. I speak to a lot of my old professors, and I see them around. When I go back home or go back to campus, I go see them. Go to their office and talk to them, see how they're doing, catch up. You know, I have a really good relationship with a lot of my professors back in my alma mater. So.
Yeah. And they like to keep tabs on you. They help you out, you know.
They keep tabs on me. And then I went to the rival school for grad school, so you know, a lot of them had dealt with me for a little while. Just but,
I'll say this because I went to majority school for graduate school, and I'll say this in a black school you are certainly more than a number. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it may not be every professor, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they certainly can't have relationships with every student. But I find that teachers at black schools tend to be a little bit more caring about sort of the well-being and the welfare of students in their classes. So they may not be able to talk to you every day. They may not be able to take an hour out, you know, in their office to have a conversation. But they're gonna kind of try to give you some guidance, you know what I mean? And some real,
I know exactly what you mean. I think a lot of times when they look at their students, they see themselves. Like they see, I was that student my first year. I was that student my second year. I was that student my third year. You know, and I think a lot of times they can look at the personalities and be like, well, I know these students are gonna be okay. I may need to, you know, pull this student to the side and talk to them and kind of keep them focused. That student's gonna be the class clown. You know, I think a lot of times they see that when they teach at, you know, HBCUs and your professors, or you know, they look at you and they're like, I see me. So you know, I think they relate more to you, and they're able to really give you a lot of guidance that you may not get anywhere else. You know,
right. I mean, I had teachers, I had instructors who saw potential in me, and they mm-hmm. saw potential in me, and they took an interest in me in ways that I don't think that I would have gotten had I gone to a majority school. You know, like, have you mm-hmm. considered that you might be able to do these things too? You know, I know you said you
yeah.
wanted to do that. You know what I mean? And it started me down a whole other path, you know, like something that wasn't even in my mind to do.
I so agree. I remember my first year teacher, one of my teachers, he took an interest in me and still takes an interest in me up to this point. I remember when I first got to, you know, undergrad, I kind of, you know, typical freshman. I didn't go to class a lot. I kind of, you know, played around a little bit. You know how it is when you first get to college. You just mm-hmm. enjoying that freedom, you know. So,
yeah.
you know, he pulled me to the side. I was like, you have potential.
Well, actually, I don't know exactly because I had a different kind of experience my first year. It was kind of weird.
Oh,
I'll talk about that one offline. I think I might have
yeah,
told you before, but you might not remember. We'll talk about that offline.
But I wasn't living
on campus initially when
okay.
I started school.
Well, when I first got to, we'll have that conversation later, but
yeah.
I kind of, you know, wasn't going to class a lot. I was really, you know, I really wasn't focused. I really didn't want to be there. And my teacher pulled me to the side. He was like, you know, you got potential. You know, because I never really had to study most of the time in my major, political science, because I've always loved politics. I've always loved, you know, social science. So if you start applying yourself and studying a little bit more, and, you know, if you find something that you can't, you know, you go to class, you find something, and we talk about it, but we don't touch it, go and research it and add it to your repertoire, you know, and really build your knowledge base. And I took that to heart, and I started really, it took me a while. You know, it wasn't immediate. It took maybe a year before I really started paying attention to what he was telling me. You know, I started really just going and researching and really building my knowledge base when it comes to my field. You know, so I'm really glad that person really sat there and talked to me. It really gave me the attention that I needed at the time, you know, coming from high school. You know, I was coming from boarding school, and I was coming from a different environment. But I really enjoy that. You know, it's something I think about to this day.
So we didn't get to, so when I asked you about, like, what, you know, to tell everybody about yourself a little bit earlier, and mm-hmm. and we haven't really talked about this a whole lot either, because you know what it is. It's like, you know, you get off into the world and you kind of do your own thing. And so, like, you don't necessarily mm-hmm. keep, like, as good contact with people, but like, you still keep in touch. You know what I mean? Which mm-hmm. is kind of what has been the situation that you and I have been in. But I know that you're interested in political science, and mm-hmm. you have some great political views. But what is your interest in terms of political science? Are you doing research in political science, or are you striving to go in a different direction?
I really don't know. I love research. I've done a lot of research. I've done research on a lot of social different
and
political behaviors.
What research in?
Oh wow. I've done research on socioeconomic factors that influence political behavior. That was more my thesis project when I talked about how our age, race, gender, sex, education, how they play a role in how a person would vote more so. And that's one of the little different areas I looked at when I was, you know, in grad school. I looked at system justification. A theory that talks about how people within a system who are more discriminated against will justify that system, out of being comfortable with it or whatnot. I looked at that field. I looked at historical, you know, political science. I looked at historical significance of the civil rights movement. I've looked at different other minority groups in their different civil rights and human rights movement. I've looked at a lot of different fields. I don't really know what I really want to do in political science right now. I just know I love it, and I like different fields within it. So, you know, I can research, you know, I can probably, you know, teach a little bit.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions before we get into, like, legal marijuana, because the first thing I want to ask you is what is your opinion, because this is a question that I see people talk, or this is an issue that I see people talk about a lot. But I want to know, in your particular opinion, someone who's researched, you know, civil rights history and, you know, mm-hmm. the way that people vote and all this sort of thing, what is your view on integration. And did integration help or hurt more?
Wow. You know, it's like, this is... I come with the heavy questions.
But I'm never
been afraid of heavy questions anyway. So, but
yeah,
asking that question is like asking it's a multi layer question.
Yeah.
What are you looking for? What I mean, when you ask that question, what are you looking? Are you looking for statistically? Has it been better for African Americans historically, politically? I mean, what angle are you looking at? Socially,
honestly, this is the way the question is.
That's why I say I asked that question, because there's so many different layers.
And I've seen lots of different answers. So I guess we can talk about. So objective. So like,
I told
from
you.
An objective standpoint, which I know, right? But see, this is not necessarily a question for me. Like, this is not something I think about on a daily basis. But I've just seen a couple people talking about it on Facebook, and I've heard people ask this question repeatedly. I think
a lot of my friends have had this discussion.
Yeah, I think from just an objective standpoint, in terms of, you know, whether or not human beings should be black people should be visible in society, that black people should have a place in society, have the ability to move in society as they choose. I think that just objectively the answer to that question is yes, it's been beneficial. Now, you know, what else comes along with that, you know, is not necessarily the economic justice.
So you're leaving the heavy part of the question to me to finish. I don't know. I'm trying to start this question off. Okay. What you just said, socially, it's been beneficial. Politically, it's been beneficial. But looking at other ways, it hasn't been beneficial. Integration hasn't worked to some extent because, you know, you had African Americans finally being able to, quote unquote, integrate into society, to mainstream society. But a lot of times, if you look at the history books and a lot of the political books we talk about, many of the same people who were African Americans were supposed to integrate with, they left. They didn't, you know, like I said, they moved to the suburbs. You had white flight. A lot of times, you had a lot of them starting their own schools in different areas outside the city schools, where a lot of times integration was to save money and be able to better facilitate schools in the city. Am I right? So, and you know, school money is taxpayer money, which is taken from taxes. And when people leave an area, you know, you lose revenue. Am I right? So, In speaking in society, integrating people together and teaching the humanity aspect is succeeding. But looking at real dollars and cents and looking at its ultimate goal, it failed. Integration, it didn't do what it was supposed to do. It didn't go far enough.
Yeah.
That's what I meant to say. Right. It didn't go far enough.
I think it's all a perspective of what people believe integration would do. Now, some people thought integration would be a panacea to, you know, to all of the issues that black people faced. And it wasn't. It because they didn't address all those other factors that Martin Luther King thought to, you know, do, you know, very late in his career, you know, before he, you know, was assassinated, to address economic inequality. You know what I mean? And all of those sorts of other fronts. You know what I mean? That we have to think about. That's the problem.
That's the problem
we didn't address when we were pushing for integration. We thought that if we just pushed for the ability to use the same drinking fountains and have access to the same, you know, schools and neighborhoods and whatever, that we would just resolve the problem, or the issue would resolve itself, and it just didn't.
That's why I asked you what angle did you want to look at the question. You want to look at it socially, politically. Socially and politically, yes, it was effective. It was very effective.
Yeah.
It finally, you know, brought African Americans to the table of mainstream government. Now, if you look at, like I said, if you look at I mean, the other factors, you know, it wasn't really made. Like you say, it wasn't really made for that. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it wasn't thought out correctly, but its effectiveness was limited on its approach, if that makes sense.
Right.
Maybe. And it should have been built on a lot more, I think.
I think the approach was curtailed because of the perceptions of radicalism and, you know, communist fear. You know what I mean? Is what really drove all of, you know, a lot of the major players in civil rights to, you know, focus primarily on the aspect of being visible and the aspect of being able to use the same, you know, lunch counters and restrooms, you know what I mean, rather than talking about the fact that they were being systematically shut out, you know, of economic opportunity and other things. So that, I think that's really where the problem came in.
It was the far-sightedness. I mean, a lot of times, if you look at a lot of policies and laws, long-term they're thought to be great, but short-term, the details, the devil is usually in the details, they always say. The details on implementing them are usually flawed, if that makes sense, a lot of times. Mm-hmm. You have a, you know, like I give them like Obamacare. The idea of it is great. You're including more people into the system, people being able to have health care. The problem is usually with the details. You know, a lot of times you don't go in the detail of how it's supposed to be effective or how it's supposed to impact different people. And that's the same thing with integration, you know, a lot of different policies, affirmative action, I think a lot of policies, in the long term, they're great policies, but in the short term, the details are never really worked out and they become flawed and they become a liability to the whole entire, you know, topic, if you understand what I'm saying on that particular issue.
Yeah, no, I understand. I agree with you. Obamacare in principle is an awesome idea, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, because of the way that it's written, and because it doesn't build into it any protection against insurance companies overcharging, you know, or hospitals overcharging, you know, for things like the little pill cuts.
Those were taken out by certain people.
My point is that the principle is great, but the way that it's implemented is not so great and actually may do more harm than good in the long run. When really all we should have in the first place is Medicare for everybody. But, you know, but.
I agree. I think that's what a lot of our ideas, they are great ideas, but they don't have the detail or, you know, the substance to support it and to sustain it. You know, I think that's, you know, I mean, that's a lot of ideas. If you look at a lot of the past ideas that people came with 20, 30, 40 years ago, they're falling apart now because at the time we were so, like I said earlier, we're so concerned with throwing money or a quick remedy, we don't take the time to really work out the details, you know.
It's also hard to work out all those details when you're working against people whose entire objective is to basically bankrupt government into the point where, you know, it basically will you know, be states, you know, responsibility to do all of these things. And the funny part about it is a lot of these states that have these people trying to bankrupt the government are the same people who are actually taking the greatest proportion of the money. But it's funny.
I saw this article somewhere. They talked about where most of the health care money was going to were some of the same states that were voting against the Obamacare and any type of health care reform. It's really interesting to me. I say life is where irony and with a lot of different, you know, both sides of the coin. The same states they're voting against are the same states that need the money the most. I mean, it's like I said,
see,
like,
and this, is why, and this is why it almost feels like, even though I don't subscribe to a lot of conspiracy theories, like on some levels when you watch this stuff happening, you kind of have to think in the back of your mind, like, this is all, like, you know, you're defunding the schools, you want everybody to go to a voucher system, you know, you want to kind of dismantle public education, you want to introduce all of these, you know, nonsensical, you know, teachings into it, you want to basically teach, you know, creationism alongside mm-hmm. you know, evolution, you know what I mean, as though, you know, they're both scientific when they're not, you know what I mean, you want to do all of these things,
yeah.
And it's basically undermining our ability to educate our populace, and a democracy, in my mind, and, you know, can really only work when you have an educated population. So it seems
the
elements of the right really don't want people to be educated, that it serves their purpose.
The question is this a democracy? That's what you have to look at the underlying question. Is it a democracy? Huh?
No, it's not. I guess. I mean, it's a republic.
Is it a republic? Is it a republic or a democracy?
It's a republic.
Okay.
But there was a time that it seemed like we were heading toward democracy.
I'm not saying if it's a democracy or a republic. I'm just asking the question.
I think it's clear that it's more of a republic, certainly now than ever before. But in any case. Those of us who want democracy want people to be educated, not just because, you know, it's the right thing
it's
better to work out here with people who aren't complete, you know, idiots when it comes to,
I mean,
you know,
but
very
is that
basic
conducive
things.
For a republic for maintaining control to educate more people into the fold? Asking questions, like Socrates.
No.
I'm asking questions. Just asking questions.
No, but we want it to be a democracy, and we want to sell democracy to everybody else, but we don't practice
democracy
it.
Is not – I'm just saying from a historical point of view and political, democracy doesn't work everywhere. I mean, it's a form of government. There are different forms of government.
Mm-hmm.
One form of government doesn't work everywhere.
I don't know. I think America just needs a benevolent dictatorship
So you just forgot about 240 years of history of why we don't have a dictatorship.
I don't mean we literally need a benevolent dictator, but you know what I mean. Sometimes it feels like. Like, you know, it would just be great if we just had
oligarchy more so. Oligarchy. It feels like an oligarchy more so.
It would be great if we had someone who actually had, like, you know, human welfare in mind. You know what I mean? Who could just take over and say, okay, this is some nonsense. You know, free education, free health care, everybody has access to their basic needs. You know what I mean? And this is where we start.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That would just be brilliant. You know?
I don't agree with that because I historically tyrants and that doesn't work. I mean, you just have to.
Well,
I think
you know
it's
what
a
I mean.
Difference.
Like I'm just I being. I, I'm not thinking in a realistic frame right now. I'm just saying, sometimes I get so frustrated with the way that the system works that I wish that there were just someone who could just come in and just say, "All right, kids. I'm going to take away these toys. We're going to do this.
Yeah.
We're going to be just about this. You know what I mean? We have to share the toys. You know?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I just think, you know, I think you have to have a blend of different styles in government. One style doesn't always work. You have to be able to blend things together. And I think a lot of times we've been sold on the fact that democracy so much that we forget that democracy, you know, doesn't work sometimes. It has its fault. It has its fails. It has its failures.
Yeah.
It has its downsides, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes other systems work for different people. I mean, and sometimes you have to change up your style, you know, or your way of doing things to get different results. They say insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, believing there's going to be a different result.
That's right.
Saying.
That's true.
So
Okay, now my glimmer of hope is fading. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. I do that from time to time. My friends say I give them the greatest hope of America, then sometimes just dash it away.
Yeah, it's just gone.
I told you I go from two extremes a lot of times. I go from yay to yay again. Yeah.
Well, I hope that you guys aren't leaving this conversation as depressed as I am.
Oh, too funny. No, what I found interesting about the last few comments that you all made regarding education and, you know, again, for those of you who aren't able to get a quote-unquote formal education, with the internet, you can go out and you can be self-taught. You can teach yourself. You know, look on Black Freethinkers Wall. We post enough stuff. We have given you an education in the past 2 years that surpasses a lot of grad school education. Go and read, buy some books, free links to books. All of that information is up there. And what I find interesting is when I forget the gentleman's name, Eric Canton, when he was talking about President Obama, when President Obama said that he wanted to make sure that everybody was able to go to college and be able to afford it, Canton's response was, "What a snob." And that supports, you know, Patrick's theory just now when he said that basically they don't want you to be educated because it will disrupt their power system. And what a lot of people don't realize and don't know unless you study some economics is that it is by design that a certain percentage of the, you know, population is unemployed. And then it's designed that another certain percentage of the population is in service-related positions. I mean, we are all of service to one another, don't get me wrong, but there are certain type of low-paying, low-wage positions that are specifically designed for a certain segment of the population.
She just said it. That's, I mean, you have to look at it. I mean, if you look at what we're taught in political science, no more than 10% of the population is supposed to be unemployed. I mean, the government's ran on numbers. I mean, that's how it works. In order for the government to maintain effectiveness, it needs this amount of tax revenue.
At least within capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, I mean,
percentage of unemployment.
I'm not saying that the government's behind this, but I'm just saying, I just look at the numbers. I mean,
Exactly, and that's the reason why we, you know, we share this information.
So we
with
started
you guys
off saying that the Illuminati is not real, and now we're giving
no,
it's
not.
To it. No, I'm kidding.
No, it's not real. It's just, you have a power. In any society, you have a power. You have a power vacuum that is really hard to penetrate, and you have to penetrate it. It takes 10, 20, 100, 200, 300 years before the power vacuum is penetrated. But when you do, you have to make sure that you have a system or a government or a set of rules that are going to replace the, you know, the problem. A lot of times we have a problem when you have a coup or people who revolt against a particular system of rule. When you have that power back and it's gone, you have chaos and despair and, you know, the last couple of years you've had in North Africa and in the Middle East, you had those different power vacuums and then you had nothing to replace it. And then you've had chaos and destruction. You have to have, like I said, America, you know, is still the example, you know, every 4 years or every 2 years, when a particular party loses, the other one, you know, takes over, it's mainly bloodless. I mean, it's something that's remarkable for still to this day, you know, that still doesn't happen to this day in a lot of countries, you know. So the elements of the government are still beautiful. That, you know, but you still have a lot of these problems that need to be worked on. I mean, it's a work in progress. I mean, that's any growing living thing, you work in progress. You work on it. You progress as time goes on. But we become stagnant when you die. And America's reached a point when it's becoming more stagnant, it needs to be changed.
It just makes me sad. Okay, I'm going to
Now I got to cheer you up.
Here we go. I'm going to go have several drinks after this show. Thank you so much, Robert. Russia.
Wow. You blamed this on me?
Yeah, I came in here, you know, with a you know, semblance of optimism, and now, like, it's just been ripped away. But it's okay. I'll live, I think.
I give it, I take it away.
Robert give it, and Robert take it away.
Take it away. I'm operating it all the time. But eventually I put a blink in the center afterwards, so you'll be all right. You get your glimmer back.
Anywho, well, well, guys, I think the last thing that we have is legal marijuana. So,
this is a touchy subject.
What are your thoughts on legal marijuana?
I
don't usually like talking about this because generally speaking, people, like, it seems like there's not really, like, a group of people who can really take this issue really seriously. Like, you have, like, the people who are, like, just always anti-marijuana just on the basis of it being a drug.
I'm
you know what I mean? And then you have the people who are like, so pro-marijuana that they can't see any issues with smoking marijuana. And then in the middle is me saying, look, I don't see why there's any reason that an adult should not be able to smoke marijuana the same way that an adult can choose to have an alcoholic beverage or to smoke tobacco.
But that does not mean that is
awesome. Just like I don't think that, you know, drinking alcohol, particularly drinking alcohol in excess or smoking in excess of anything in excess is not a good idea. You know what I mean? But I think that if you're an adult, you can make a decision to have a joint or to have a cigarette or to have some alcohol.
I agree with that sentiment. I feel, you know, we allow people, you know, to smoke at 18, people to drink at 21. You should be able to, when I was younger, I thought about a career in politics one day. And I thought about a lot of things, but what I say, what I don't say. But in this situation, I don't have a problem with it. I think you should legalize it. I mean, I think if you send kids off to war at 18, you allow them to smoke cigarettes at 18, you allow them to drink at 21. Between the ages of 18 and 21, they should be able to make a decision if they want to smoke pot. That's just how I feel. I mean, and then once you open up that avenue and you have, like I said earlier, if you can have this discussion on topics like this, you can open your way for other topics. I mean, legalized marijuana, you can tax it, you can raise revenue, you can do whatever you want to. If you want to have some, you have to have a permit.
And not just that, but you can also regulate how it's grown. And
You open up so many different avenues. If you say, okay, we're going to have legalized marijuana, okay, you can grow it. But you have to have this, this, and this. It can't be this tall, can't be that tall. It has to be, you know what I'm saying, you can set regulations.
Right.
This is one of those few issues in our country where you can hit the ground running and setting regulations and do it the right way, you know, and really get ahead of it. But like
and
I
not
say,
just
most,
that, but you
no.
know what? I think the other problem that we're also having too is that, and this is just from the tobacco stance too, because you know when they initially started making like the tobacco industry responsible for like you know sending making those advertisements and having it taxed. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That we pack it. There was supposed to be coming down the pipe other ways to consume tobacco for consumers, and they've actually stopped a lot of that at the legislative level. And I think that that's a bad idea. You know, I mean, obviously you can also chew tobacco, but there were supposed to be other methods that one could use to consume tobacco. You know, whether they were going to make, like, drinks with tobacco, you know, like, that are based on tobacco, just like there are drinks that are based off of marijuana, you know what I mean? There's other ways that it can be consumed. And I think that actually blocking that also is a bad idea, the same way that blocking legalizing marijuana is a bad idea, because if you reduce people's desire to smoke it, you can actually solve a lot of health problems. You know what I mean? Related to secondhand smoke, related to, you know, lung cancer. You know what I mean? If you reduce their desire to use snuff, you can perhaps get rid of a lot of oral cancer. You know what I mean? Just because there'll be other avenues to use it. And by introducing it in other consumable products, you can also cut back on a lot of those other things that that are sometimes added to the cigarette, but also the process that are introduced in the process of burning, because when you burn anything, you create polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which actually are carcinogenic. So even even though the tobacco itself may not be a carcinogen and some of the additives are, if you take away the additives and you take away the smoke and you put it in something else, you can get somebody to have that feeling that they get from having nicotine without all of the cancer risk. And I think that would be a great thing.
You just took me to school. I agree. I think I agree with everything you just said. I think that we should just work. I mean, we should work on, you know, education. But, you know, like I said earlier, education is what keeps people in the dark about things. You don't educate them. You keep, you know, I think sometimes the tobacco industry is against it because it's going to cut into their profits. I mean, they're in the business to make money, you know.
Right.
And
the tobacco companies have been wanting to get these other types of products to the market, but they're blocked right now. And I just don't understand why, because we could get so many people who are smoking to stop smoking. You know what I mean? And you could save children who are exposed to secondhand smoke. You can save other families potentially. You know what I mean? And then the other thing is these electronic cigarettes. Like, you know, there needs to be a lot of research on electronic cigarettes, because, you know, there's some fear about what they're actually inhaling. You know what I mean? But you know, we could do research into that. We could, you know, potentially figure out a way to make people have the smoking experience without the smoke. You know what I mean? Like, and without the harm. And I just think that, you know, our attitude towards, you know, towards drugs and towards marijuana and now towards tobacco is stopping us from actually, you know, reducing a lot of these health problems. You know?
I agree. I just think that we like I said earlier, we're so indifferent now. You know, like we're stuck. We're stuck in not really looking at the problem anymore. We just look at, you know, the addiction. We don't treat the whole person. We criminalize it, or we make it hard for the person to smoke. Like, it's so hard. If you do smoke, they make it hard for you to do it. But if you're determined to do it, you're still going to do it. You know, any type of addiction, you need is counseling, education.
And perhaps it would be easier for somebody to stop smoking if they had access to their nicotine in other ways, and in ways that don't necessarily mark them like a patch. You know what I mean? Like, when somebody sees the patch, they know what that's for. You know what I mean? So,
that's true. It's just, it's probably just, like I said, the questions that we may never have an answer to. It's going to take one or a group of bright minds to come up with different ways in which we can do that.
Without stigmatizing people or needlessly putting people in prison.
But our problem is that our country is based on stigmatizing people and categorizing people. And so, like I said, going back to what we said earlier, you have to change that mindset. How do you go about doing that when it's been part of our mindset since the beginning? That's I think, like I said, a lot of problems that are connected, that we have to get to the root of all of these different problems. And if we can do it all at the same time, we have a chance to really change, you know, a lot of people's thinking and perception on things.
Right. It's a lot. It's a big task. But I hope you guys had fun listening to our conversation. I hope that Robert did not steal your glimmer of hope for the future.
I was trying to bring it back at the end. I really was. Because I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic it's going to work out. It's been around for this long. It'll be long after I'm gone. So I think everything will be all right. I'm not really... I'm not really optimistic about the process, but I know the short term the results will be all right, you know. So.
I'm not so sure anymore. I was sure when we started the call, but I'm not so sure anymore.
You're not putting this all on me. You're not doing it.
But in any case, I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. We had a lot of fun. Hope you guys learned something. Support HBCUs. They need you. and support women, you know, not just because they're your moms or your sisters or, you know, your wives or your daughters, but just because it's the right thing to do. It just is. And support, you know, support all your fellow human beings, basically, and their rights.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, guys, hope you guys learned something again. Loved having you. Loved having Robert on the show. Robert, you're welcome to call in anytime. I'm going to come back.
Okay, thank you.
And tomorrow, Kim will be on, and Kim's show tomorrow is on, what was it, misogyny in the Black church, or?
Oh, I like
religion and Black male privilege.
Whoa, I like that. Oh, I like that topic. That's an interesting topic.
So I hope you guys enjoy that. Probably be on there with Kim tomorrow. So you guys have a great day. And until next time, see you soon or hear you soon. Sorry.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Black free thinkers, where we walk by sight with a bright flashlight to illuminate night. Free thought, we don't walk by faith in the lost mind state, cause it's not quite safe. We don't recruit, we're not peers from a church, so don't be spooked, we're not here to convert. The only truth, if not pulled from a text, show me proof that's not good after death. This is the challenge to think for yourself, break it out of the bottle and speak what you felt. 310-982-4273 to get through, a venue for community, and this is the zone. If you'd like to speak with Kim, then pick up the phone. 310-982-4273 to get through. The next tree branch is Rainer, and it's best you listen to reason, science, and skepticism. It's loaded with straight facts, inspiring and dope. She can make Bill Nye retire his lab coat. Humans are hilarious, and every other Friday, I'd like to hear commentary on culture, people. So I hit up Super Mario and bring in Emmeline to discuss why we're capable of ultra evil. It's normal for my brain to have a two-way street, but if it's collisions, well then you got to just mention it. And don't be afraid of where the truth may lead, ignoring your position of cognitive dissonance. When Father Teresa preaches, it's hard to stop. So Kim paired me up with Alfred in the barbershop. I have extended family and all these places now, as the free thought tree pollinates around here. This is the challenge to...